This is 4:55 on Monday, September 12th. This computer is faster. The clock is faster than my laptop. The one in the other room where I teach is slower than my laptop. But this difference should be no more than a few milliseconds. Things are done right. So the fact that I can notice it with my own two eyes is suggesting of something wrong. Anyway, we're going here, right? So today we're going to start talking about the Donahue and Calvert book, the Socket Programming in C book, as part of the preparation for helping you with the first assignment. The question has come up, can I do the first assignment in language X for various X? And the answer is no. The first assignment needs to be done in C because it's the C implementation that underlies all the other ones. And so to really understand the choices made in the other designs, you sort of have to understand what the issues are in the C one. So I insist that this first assignment be done in C, and then after that we can be more flexible, because frankly I don't like pounding my head against C either. It's just that there is a certain value in dealing with its foibles and seeing what issues arise. So that's that. Any other questions from last time? Next time? All right. Well, do sign in if you haven't already. We're not going to do any questions this morning, but you might want your laptops up for looking at man pages and other things as we go along. It could be helpful, so don't necessarily put them away, but we're not going to be doing any questions this morning. Okay, where are we? Wrong class. Right class. Okay, so the material now is drawn from the little paperback book, A Practical Guide for Programmers, TCP/IP Sockets in C. As I said, the either edition is fine. I noticed that the newer edition does have some better information about doing host name lookups, some more modern information about that, and also more modern information about IP version 6. So if you have a choice, and they're roughly the same price, go for the second edition. But either one will get you through what needs to be done here. And now my computer is not working. So we'll take a slight time out for restarting the world. Meanwhile, well, that's doing its thing. So, we've not really talked about network addressing yet. We've sort of barely only touched on the transport layer. And so, we sort of have to go into reverse mode at this point and talk about those lower level things in order to actually be able to do something at the application layer where we really want to be. We don't need any of this. Sometimes when I change the change the screen resolution or attach the projector, it just stops responding to input. So anyway, we're going to be talking about sort of lower level stuff than we've talked about up to this point, but in a sort of generic way, or just enough detail to get done what we need to get done in this assignment. I do suggest that as part of your working on this assignment, you download the code for the Echo client and server associated with the Donahue and Calvert book, and just get it working. Just, you know, see what it takes to get that C code working. Where somebody else wrote the C code, it gets you through the compiler and the linking and the running and all those steps. And you can look at the code, too, as an example. So we've talked before about the Internet Protocol being a unreliable datagram protocol, providing best effort service. It can lead to loss. It's not so obvious, but it can also reorder packets. It can even duplicate packets. That's pretty rare that you see duplication, but it can happen. It's not a, there's no guarantee against it. And variable delay. And remember, the IP protocol is at the network layer, which means that it contains the information needed to deliver packets from one host to another host. And in order to get to applications, we have to get to the transport layer. So, now details that we haven't talked about yet, although many of you are probably familiar with them. IP version 4, host identifiers, they're actually host interface identifiers, are 32 bits, 4 bytes. And when we write them down, the convention is that we write those 4 bytes as 4 decimal numbers separated by periods. So each of the numbers here ranges from 0 to 255, and there are 4 of them. The reasons for writing them in decimal are buried in ancient history. It seems like a little odd thing to do given what they were, but that's what they did. And remember last time we talked about DNS, DNS translates these DNS names into the IP addresses in their numerical form, so that you can actually inject packets into the network and have them go where you want them to go. And as it says here, and I said before, IP address identifies a particular network interface on a host, not the host. So a host can have multiple network interfaces. They may all have different addresses. This is actually worth keeping in mind when you have hosts that have multiple interfaces on them, because certain kinds of bizarre behavior, undesirable behavior, can arise from having different addresses. Okay, so the transport layer then is layer, in the numbered scheme, layer 4. Network layer is 3, link layer is 2, physical layer is 1. Layer 4 in the layered nomenclature adds some services on top of that host-to-host unreliable datagram delivery. The minimum thing that you need to add is a port number in order to address the particular applications on a host instead of just the host itself. And it's also nice to add a checksum over the data, just so that you're sure that what the packet arrives in the same form that it was sent. That's it turns out to be part of the transport layer rather than the network layer. The and we talked last time a little bit about TCP being a stream-oriented protocol that strives to achieve reliability as well. Okay. So to identify the actual destination of a packet, you need to provide the IP address for the host, which will get the which IP, and IP will take care of getting the packet there, and then a port number, which is 16 bits in TCP/IP related protocols, that tell you either sort of globally what service should be running there, in the case of the well-known ports like 80 for WWW and 25 and 23 for email and telnet, or you can also do things in a way where you just sort of pick a number and you figure out how it works in during the connection setup phase for TCP. So we'll see instances of that where the client in a TCP connection in making its request of the server essentially tells the server what port number it should come back to with. We'll see that. Okay, we briefly talked about the socket interface. The socket interface, remember, there's a picture here on the next slide. The socket interface tells us how application programs interact with operating systems about networking. And then the operating systems go on and have the actual interactions with the network. So this socket interface defined in the Berkeley Systems Group in the mid-80s is sort of almost universally, probably not in some embedded systems, but almost universally used as the model for the interactions between applications and operating systems. And this is very good because it means that even though, you know, you may learn to program the network on a Windows machine when you move to a Unix machine, at least conceptually the ideas are the same. The details differ, but the fundamental structure is the same for both kinds of operating systems. So here's the picture that I wanted to say. So, from the perspective of applications, let's see something here. Is there something on the next slide? No. Okay, this one I'll look at. From the perspective of applications, a socket is a file descriptor on Unix-y systems, and a socket handle on Windows-y systems. But it's just a value as far as the application is concerned that you need to pass in certain places to the operating system API in order to get things done. And it turns out that in the Unix-y systems that value comes from the same space as file descriptors, and so you can do all the things with it that you can do with a file descriptor. You can dupe it and close it and pass it to a child process by forking, and all that stuff just works in the way that file descriptors do. And you can read and write on it as well. Whereas in Windows, they made the the socket handle, not handy, handle, be a different kind of thing that just has socket operations available on it, and a few other things. So that's one difference. But nevertheless, this socket thing is the value that an application program holds on to in order to talk to the network. And we'll see how you get one and what you can do with it as we go through this material. So the applications hold on to a value called a socket. They pass it across the operating system interface to the operating system through using system calls of various kinds. And depending on what kind of socket it is, the operating system code for either TCP or UDP then handles those system calls and eventually gets down through the network layer, well, the transport layer and the network layer, associating a particular port number. Remember, the port numbers are the things that are in the transport layer protocol. Particular port number gets associated with a socket. Right, so sockets and ports are not the same thing, but there's a close relationship between them. Port number is just a 16-bit value as seen out in the network world. A socket is a file descriptor-like thing or a object handle in Windows. Okay, is that clear? It's important to keep these two things straight. They're closely related, but they're not the same. Okay, so how do you get one of these? The system call is socket. This is one way to get a socket. We'll see some others as we go. So you start, but this is how you start out. So you say, I want a socket. It belongs to protocol family internet. It goes there. And it is, say, a stream socket. Goes there. And the protocol we want is TCP. So these all caps things are pound defined in the appropriate header files in the C world. Okay. So why do you have to say these things? Well, turns out that sockets are actually used for things besides internet communication, IP communication. You can use them to do novell-style communication. You can use them to do some kinds of communication that just takes place within a single operating system, the so-called Unix family sockets. But we're doing networks, so we'll use the internet protocol family. In the internet protocol family, sockets, stream sockets and TCP go together, but in others you wouldn't have to have that same binding. So you always pass sock stream and protocol TCP or sock DGRAM and protocol UDP in the internet world. Okay, so that's how you get one. Not very interesting yet. It's just we haven't said very much about what we want, right? We've just said it's a stream socket. So the next thing is we have to have some way to communicate to the operating system about the kinds of addresses, about the internet addresses. And there are data structures, again, defined in the header files, the C header files, for this purpose. And the generic one is the so-called struct sockadder, and it only has defined a field called family, which is used to again distinguish between sock adders for the Unix domain, Novell networking, internet version 6, all that stuff. So that's the only thing that's defined there, and the rest of it is just a blank blob of data that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And then, depending on what kind of socket you're talking about, you can use a specialization of this for the particular protocol family or address family. So notice how this works. The internet family value is a short, and it takes this predefined constant value address family internet, and that's followed by a port and an internet address, struct in adder and a struct short, or an unsigned short. Okay, so we've used up 2, and that's 4, so we've used 6 bytes for this stuff, and the rest of it is not used, the rest of this space. So do you see what's going on here? We're defining an overlay, essentially, where in the generic one we have the address family, which is 2 bytes, and it's just a different way of, 2 different ways of describing 16 bytes. Is this familiar from sort of 360-ish hacking? The idea of having the same storage described in 2 different ways? Okay, good. Okay, so we're going to be describing internet addresses, and so we'll be using mostly this one. And then, picture is right there that I just drew. Same thing. All right. So we've done this before. Clients are the active parts of the active parties in communications as far as establishing connections. Servers are passively waiting. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through what it takes in terms of the socket interface now to create a server. Okay. So we'll do the right-hand side first. The order in which things happen is we create a socket, we give it a port number, we do something called telling it to listen, and then we do repeated accept calls, communicate calls, and finally close. Okay. And we'll look at how each of those things gets done. So we begin by creating a socket, and the red things here come out of the echo example from the book. So you can look these up later and see them in their full context. But we did what we said we would do. We do a socket call saying it's an internet socket, that it's a stream socket, and it's a TCP socket. And then we do something very important, which is test whether that failed or not. Right? This follows in the Unixy world, at least, it follows the convention of all the other system calls that they return a non-negative value for success and a negative value for failure. And it's very important to always check. If you do not check your return codes in your projects, and you come to me and say it doesn't work, and I don't know why, and I see that you haven't checked the return codes, I'm going to send you away to go check the return codes and figure out where it is that it broke, and then we can talk about why. But until you're checking the return codes on every system call, you're not doing it right. That's just a habit that you have to get into when programming in C. And then they implement this die with error routine, which, if you look at it, I think provides a interpretation of the erno value. Remember, the way things work in the system call interface is that when you get a negative value returned from a system call, there's a global shared variable called erno. It contains a code that a numerical code that explains why, what the cause of that error was, and that erno is turned into a string within this die with error routine so that you can interpret it mentally rather than dealing with just an arbitrary looking number. Okay, so that's how we create the socket for the server. Next step. Remember that the service has to become associated with a port somehow, and that's what this bind operation does. So the system call is really called bind. And so now bind is going to associate that socket we just created with a port number. And to do that, we build one of these struct sock adder ins that we talked about a few slides back, saying that it has an internet family, an internet address, and that it contains a that contains a particular port number that we choose, right? There needs to be a definition of echo server port somewhere up here. Okay, so that's the port number, and the address. Now, we're writing application code. We don't want to have to pay attention to what the IP address is of the server. We're running on some server. We'll let it figure out what its own IP address is, and therefore we use this pound defined value in adder any, stands for any internet address, whatever makes sense as far as the system call is concerned. Yeah, Riley.
So, if there are multiple network interfaces on the computer, then it will listen on multiple or just two?
It will. If you pass in or adder any, it will listen on all of them. Yeah. Now, the next question you should be asking is, what is this H to NL and H to NS all about? Right. So this has to do with the question of byte orders. And we're going to talk about byte order more later. But remember that some machines, like the Intel machines, use a memory architecture in which integers are stored with the low order bits in the smaller byte addresses. Yes. Low order bits in the smaller byte addresses. And that's called so-called little endian order. A machine like a PowerPC or a Spark processor does it the other way around. It stores the high order bits of an integer in the low order, in the smaller byte addresses. That's called big endian order. We're going to see pictures of this, so don't worry. However, what you got to know is both kinds of machines exist. Both kinds of machines may run the same code at different times. So the implementers of the socket interface designed a standard way to cope with this this variability of the platforms by saying the addresses that you point, that you put in these struct sock adders need to always be in network byte order. Okay, which happens to be big endian, but it doesn't really matter what it is. It's just always it exists. And in order to ensure that, you call host, that is whatever kind of computer you're running on, to network, and whatever the standard is for the network, and long for a 4-byte quantity, and that HTML will ensure that the quantity you pass to it is then in network byte order and can be stored in the sock adder data structure. And the same thing applies to the port number, except that the port number is only 2 bytes, so it's a short, so H to NS of the echo server port. Again, this is something that you can, on a big endian machine, you can avoid doing, and you can omit these calls, but it's wrong. On a little endian machine, if you omit those calls, things generally won't work very well. Okay. So again, you got to just get in the habit of doing those things, and you've got to learn the places where things need to be in network byte order versus the places where they need to be in host byte order. Is the other thing. Okay. So we've built a struct sock adder in echo serve adder. And we pass that to bind, telling it we want to associate the server socket that we just made with the socket call. Put a note on here. This came from the socket call. Okay, associate that socket with this address where we're saying really just with this particular port number. Again, we check where whether it succeeded or not, and if it didn't, we die. There's no point in going on if this fails, at least in simple programs like you're writing for your project. Okay, so up until this point, we've got a socket, we've got it bound to a port number, but the designers of this interface said we want to make it explicit in the program the point at which it first is willing to accept that it's first willing to interact with the outside world, and that's the purpose of listen. So again, you pass the same socket, and max pending is just the number of clients that you're willing to have waiting around for you to get around to them. And it's usually kind of a small number, like 4 or 5 is the sort of number that you pass there. It's not the number of clients that you can handle at the same time. It's the number that you allow to wait for you. If more clients show up than this and you haven't accepted their connections, the operating system will tell them to go away for you, and you don't have to interact with them. Okay, so that's just handy. Okay, so that's listening. And then on the server side, we use Yeah. It's a connect, con refused. So it does a reset at the TCP level, and it's reflected back to the client as a connection refused. So the next system call then is accept. And again, you pass that server socket that you did before, and you pass in a struct. That's got to be a struct sock adder in as well. So we'll do that. Need to have that defined, and the accept call takes the socket. It takes the address of one of these sock adder ins and the length of it. Now, why? Because what's going to happen when accept returns, if it succeeds, is that this data structure up here, this is going to be filled in now with the address of the client. We might care about that in our application. We might want to know what IP address it came from. And so that's provided as part of the results of accept. Again, we check for zero, but what's this? Well, this is showing us that, in fact, the socket call is not the only way to get a socket. Another way to get a socket is by using accept. And what happens is when accept returns, you get back a different socket that is now connected with the client. And when you read and write on that socket, you're going to be reading and writing in such a way that the client can write and read the same bytes. Okay, so this is a little bit tricky. The server socket is not where you write and read. The server socket is just where you accept. And then when you do accept, you get a new socket, and that's where you write and read for that particular client. When that client is done, we'll close that client socket. That connection will go away, and the next client we interact with will produce a new socket for interacting with that socket when we accept for that one. Okay? So it's accept, communicate, where is it? Okay, so at this point, the server is going to do a read on that socket. Well, okay. I guess we'll get to this later. We'll talk about how that works later. So anyway, at this point, the server is ready to send and receive on that client socket and do whatever it is that it's going to do to service the client. Let's look at the client. On the client, it goes sort of the same way. At the beginning, we create a socket. And now we don't bind it, we just connect it to the server socket by passing in a struct sock adder. You know, this is struct sock adder is a term that keeps cropping up here, right? So this is going to be important. Need to know how to manipulate these things. So we build one of these struct sock adders, but now we have to put in the IP address of the server, because this is the active end, right? It's got to know who it's going to talk to, and we also have to put in the server port. So once we've done that, we can call connect. Notice it doesn't produce anything that we really care about in terms of a result, except for the possibility of an error happening. We don't assign the result of connect to anything. And then we're ready to communicate. So, the connect operation on the client matches up with the accept operation on the server. They both, when both things are satisfied, they both go on. And they're both able to communicate. Did I miss it? Oh, yes. Okay. So, on both sides, to send things to the other guy, you use the send system call. Send. You send to a particular socket. you provide the address of a buffer. You provide the number of bytes to send, and it either works or it doesn't. There's actually a bug in here. Could be a bug in this code. It depends on what we think we're doing. And that's what we'll talk about next time in some more detail. But how many bytes does it take to represent in C? How many bytes does it take to represent that value? Nine, represented by 9 bytes. Including the null termination. What is strlen of S1? Okay. All right. So, potential bug. It depends whether it really is a bug, but at least a potential bug in this code then is that the thing that we're sending is only 8 bytes long. We're not sending the full representation of a string. We're just sending a string without the null terminator. Is that a bug? Well, we don't know because it depends on what the guy at the other end is expecting. This is something you're going to have to wrestle with in your project because I ask you to sometimes send strings as null terminated strings. And you got to watch out for the fact that strlen does not give you the size of the representation. It gives you the sort of logical size of the thing.
So in practice, do you actually just have a check for if the string's null terminated or not?
Depends on the protocol. Depends on the protocol. Because notice that it isn't a question of whether the string is null terminated on this side that matters. It's a question of whether the other guy is expecting it to be null terminated when you send it to him.
I thought you said that you can use write and read because the sock is technically like a file
description. In Unix, you can use write and read as well.
Is this specific to something else?
Send is specific to sockets. So you can use either send and receive or write and read.
They're
pretty much the same thing. Notice that if this were a write, it would end here.
Oh, okay.
This is some flags that are specific to network communication.
I
think it's clearer that you're using it on a socket if you do that. If you use zero here, it really is the same as a write. But
what
are things in the flags? There are things about pushing this data, which is, means the operating system is supposed to make sure that it sends it out as soon as it can. What else can you do in those flags? It's just a handful of little stuff. I think everything we do in this class, you're going to use zero for the flags. But you can look it up in the man pages. Okay, so that's how you send. And receive is like read. Again, you pass then on the server side, the client socket, you pass in the address of a buffer in which to receive the bytes. You pass in the size of the buffer so that the system doesn't inadvertently overwrite the memory that you had intended to be used. But it's up to you to calculate these things correctly, right? To make sure that the buffer size that you pass is really appropriate for the actual buffer value that you pass there. This is something that trips people up frequently. What is the common... Well, yeah. My preference is to do things with size of rather than constants here, but you can mess that up too, so it's not foolproof. Take size of the wrong thing, you know, or etc. Okay, so that looks like a read, except that, again, it has some flags. And so you go on doing reading and sending until you're done. And then you close the sockets. And the system call is just close, like it is for other file descriptors. Notice that we close the client socket. We don't close the server socket because we want to use the server socket to come back around and do another accept. Right? So that we can talk to another client. All right, so here's the thing that I want you to sort of get ingrained to the point that you can sort of reproduce it at will without giving it a second thought. The order of the system calls that occur on the client and on the server. Okay. So on the server, what is it? It's socket, bind, listen, accept, and then send and receive on the result. On the client, it is socket, connect, and communicate. Okay? If you get that down, then you sort of have the overall pattern of dealing with socket communication in hand. And then you are just looking up if you need to look it up, you're looking up details about what happens in each call. But nowhere do you really find written down, easily accessible, these two simple patterns. So it's really worth knowing them right off the top of your head. You don't bind the client socket to a port when that happens in the course of doing the connect. You can, in fact, if you want, but you normally don't.
Because the client's probably going to be requesting, well, then how does the client request from the server if it's not bound to the port? Because the client's going to initialize the communication, so
bind is about establishing the local end of the port.
Sure.
Remember, the connect call had something about the server end of the port, the server end of the connection. It had the server's address and port number.
Yeah,
okay?
Okay.
outside the local port, which that socket is going to be actually listening on then?
The operating system does that.
So you don't know what port you're actually locally.
And you don't need to.
Right.
That's the good thing is you generally don't need to know what port you're using as a client. Okay? If you insist, you can, but you don't have to. Great. I'll see you Wednesday.